US and Russia hold high-level strategic talks as Moscow blasts the US president's latest anti-Russia remarks. The US imposes new sanctions on several Syrian individuals and entities over alleged human rights abuses. Also ahead in the headlines, the Tunisian president says his decision to dismiss the country's government and suspend parliament was constitutional. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, the senior US and Russian officials have restarted nuclear talks and agreed to reconvene in September amid rising tensions between the two countries. The head of the Russian delegation at the summit reportedly said the United States showed readiness for constructive dialogue. The meeting in Geneva followed a verbal spat between US President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Biden accused Putin of seeking to disrupt the 2022 congressional elections by spreading what he called misinformation. The Kremlin, however, roundly rejected the claim. Earlier this month, Russia warned that relations between the two countries are nearing a dangerous confrontational threshold. The rising tensions are due to disagreements over arms control, cyber terrorism, and several other issues. Political commentator Jason Unruhe says the US has shown a definite history of essentially blaming others for its own actions.
And I think the United States has shown that it has a definite history of essentially blaming others for their own actions. I mean, we saw that when originally Hillary Clinton had lost the election against Donald Trump, there was an immediate blaming of Russia, despite the fact that the actual testimony of the investigation actually revealed the opposite, that someone had been inside the actual headquarters and had copied data via USB. Later on, there was a court case against the Democratic Party, which involved Debbie Wasserman Schultz, in which Bernie Sanders was actually removed from his position where he was about to win. So, and then when Donald Trump didn't win the election, he alleged some kind of evil satanic conspiracy. This seems to be the way the United States wants to perform all of their elections now. To when they don't win, they just blame it on something nonsensical. I mean, it's still a little bit silly to blame Russia for the recent losses, but they didn't show any evidence of that. In my opinion, there really is no evidence. That's one of the great things about the allegations of hacking and putting out misinformation. You don't have to prove anything.
The U.S. Treasury Department has slapped new sanctions on several Syrian individuals and entities. The department imposed bans on 8 Syrian prisons and 5 senior officials who control the sites over what it described as human rights abuses. Washington has intensified its sanctions campaign on Syria, targeting individuals and businesses in the Arab country. Damascus has said the U.S. measures aim to hamper efforts to revive Syria's economy that has been devastated by years of U.S.-backed militancy. Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, has visited Syria for talks with top officials there on the expansion of further economic and cooperation ties between the two sides. Our correspondent Muhammad Ali reports from Damascus.
Speaker of Iran's parliament Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Ghalibaf said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Ghalibaf held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hammoud Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibaf also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank town of Beit Omar, located north of Al-Khalil. The Palestinian health ministry said the 12-year-old Mohammed Muayyad Al-Alami died of gunshot wounds to his chest. He was killed after Israeli soldiers opened fire at a car he was riding in. Palestinian media described the attack as unprovoked. The incident comes less than 24 hours after a 41-year-old Palestinian man succumbed to injuries after being targeted by Israeli forces in the town of Beitar, north of the occupied West Bank. A new report says Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian minors with no recourse or accountability. The report by the Defense for Children International Palestine added that the children killed did not pose any threat to the Israeli forces. Mona Kandil has more in this report.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killing.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity, and second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian minors were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warned that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood. as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The Tunisian president has defended his decision to dismiss the country's government and suspend the parliament for a month. Kais Saied said he made the move to save his country from corruption and plots to sow civil strife amid a surge in misgovernance, for a faltering economy and a spiraling COVID-19 outbreak. Saied's invocation of emergency powers last Sunday sparked public anger and plunged the country into a political crisis. The president's opponents, including the country's biggest party, Ennahda, have accused him of a power grab. This is while he maintains his actions have been constitutional. So, Tunisia is experiencing a crisis which has put its young democracy in jeopardy. The crisis sparked after President Kais Saied suspended parliament and sacked the premier, as well as the defense minister. Opponents of Saied say they are ready for early elections, but at the same time warn against an autocratic regime. The situation remains intense amid heavy military deployment to parliament and other government buildings.
Tunisia is facing its worst crisis in a decade after President Kais Saied ousted the government of Prime Minister Hicham Mechichi and suspended parliament with help of the army. Saied has announced that he would assume executive authority with the assistance of a new prime minister. This is seen as the biggest challenge yet to Tunisia's democratic system. Kais Saied has also imposed a nighttime curfew across the country to prevent unrest and violence. Parliament Speaker Rashid Ghannouchi, who heads Ennahda party, has condemned Saied's decision as an assault on Tunisia's democracy.
Today we are surprised by supreme decisions that not only surprise Ennahda, but also surprise the Tunisian people and the world in a country that is proud of being the first Arab democracy and having the latest constitution.
Ennahda has played an important role in successive coalition governments. Ghannouchi has urged his supporters to take to the streets to show their anger at the president's decision. Tunisia has witnessed mass protests in several cities across the country against the government's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the dismal state of the economy.
Well, I guess Tunisia is going through turmoil and many problems, internal problems and, of course, foreign problems, because of the relationship between, for example, Ennahda and Saied with the French and with the Emirates and all these things.
The president has described his actions as constitutional and said Article 80 of the Constitution gave him power to dismiss the government, appoint a temporary administration, freeze parliament, and lift the immunity of its members.
Some have talked yesterday about a coup. I don't know in which law or political sciences school they studied. How can a coup be based on the Constitution? This is an implementation of the constitutional script. Article 80 of the Constitution gave the President of the Republic the right to take the procedures he sees necessary in the face of an imminent danger.
Many believe the main source of the problem is economy. Tunisia's economy has not been doing well ever since the 2011 revolution. While poverty, inflation and food insecurity remain high, COVID-19 has worsened the crises, especially with a heavy blow to Tunisia's tourism sector.
Tunisia witnessed a successful revolution back in 2011. Back then, Tunisians ousted the country's former Western-backed ruler, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, following mass protests. Many believe the revolution failed to deliver prosperity or good governance.
And I guess the issue is very, very deep and profound, because there's a great conflict between these people in the government, who have made a kind of collaboration between the secularists and Ennahda movement. Ennahda movement, through its relations with the Turks and Ben Saied with the Emirates and the French and the NATO, there is a problem.
President Saied is reported to have requested critical financial assistance from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt in order to stave off the crisis. Saudi Arabia and the UAE are seen as opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood. Ennahda, which is an important force in Tunisia's political landscape, is said to have close ties with the Muslim Brotherhood. In recent years, Ennahda has sought to distance itself from the Brotherhood. Regional allies of Ennahda, including Turkey and Qatar, have sharply criticized President Saeed's moves.
What will do, what will make probably a possible exit from this crisis is that to go all of them to a new constitution that would distribute the legitimacies and the privileges of the institutions, the constitutional institutions, into a new relationship that depends on the election, on the people, to go to a new referendum about the situation in Tunisia. But I guess the situation in Tunisia is going to really deteriorate and accelerate more in a dangerous manner.
Opponents of President Saeed have likened him to Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who deposed the Brotherhood's elected former president, Mohamed Morsi, and banned the group in 2013.
The United Nations has called for the opening of critical aid routes in Ethiopia's war-torn Tigray region, warning that the region risks running out of food supplies. The UN humanitarian agency OCHA said in a statement that about 150 trucks with food and other supplies are being held in the city of Semero. Now, access into Tigray was cut off last week after the only available route for aid delivery was made inaccessible following an attack on a World Food Programme convoy. The region has been the scene of fighting between army forces and rebels. Hundreds of people have been killed and tens of thousands of others displaced since the conflict began last November.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Canada installed an Indigenous woman as its Governor General on Monday, 26th of July, the first such person to hold the post in an elaborate ceremony that spotlighted the country's efforts to reconcile with its colonial past. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau named Mary Simon, a former journalist, ambassador, and Inuit community advocate, to serve as a representative in Canada of its head of state, Queen Elizabeth, earlier this month. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Steve Shearer. It has been taken from the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, Canada Installs First Indigenous Governor-General, Highlights Reconciliation. Canada installed an Indigenous woman as its Governor-General on Monday, 26th of July, the first such person to hold the post in an elaborate ceremony that spotlighted the country's efforts to reconcile with its colonial past. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau named Mary Simon, a former journalist, ambassador, and Inuit community advocate, to serve as a representative in Canada of its head of state, Queen Elizabeth, earlier this month. Mary Simon is the first Indigenous person to take on the role, created more than 400 years ago to represent the colonial power on North American soil. The change comes as Canada grapples with the legacy of its treatment of its Indigenous population. We need people like Ms. Simon because we need people to build bridges and bring us together, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said at the ceremony. Since May, hundreds of unmarked graves of children have been discovered at former residential schools run for Indigenous children forcibly separated from their families in what a Truth and Reconciliation Commission has called cultural genocide. I have heard from Canadians who describe a renewed sense of possibility for our country and hope that I can bring people together, Simon, a 73-year-old, said, after being installed as Governor-General. The ceremony, broadcast by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, also in Simon's native Inuktitut language, was scaled back and face masks were worn due to COVID-19. A drummer accompanied her entry into the Senate, where she took an oath. The Governor-General performs functions such as swearing in governments and formally signing legislation, but is also the Commander-in-Chief of the Canadian military and can summon or dissolve the Parliament. Over a span of nearly 2 months, more than 1,300 unmarked graves have been discovered at the sites of four former residential schools across Canada, a fraction of the more than 130 residential schools once funded by the federal government. At least 150,000 Indigenous children were sent to residential schools, a system of forced assimilation that sought to strip the youth of their identity. Because the schools were notoriously brutal, the existence of unmarked graves at the site of the schools has long been known within Indigenous communities in Canada. As the number of sites discovered grows, so too have questions over how to proceed amid concerns over protocol, logistics, and proper ceremony. Children from different communities often attend the same school. Some First Nations might want to exhume all the graves at a particular residential school, while others might only want to mark and commemorate the site. In 2015, Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission estimated that as many as 4,100 children had died attending the schools, but many now believe that figure must be revised upwards in light of recent discoveries. Disease was rampant in many of the schools and children forced to attend died at a far higher rate than the general population. But the age of the remains presents challenges in identifying the cause of death. During testimony to Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, many survivors of the residential schools said that children were sometimes beaten to death at the schools.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and since we're on the threshold of the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Qadir, the day God finalized the issue of succession to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, here is some food for thought from his divinely appointed vicegerent, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Unfortunate is he who cannot gain a few sincere friends during his lifetime. And more unfortunate is the one who has gained them and then lost them through his deeds.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
A
Faisal Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Now, the stage has come now where we speak about how to deal with enemies, or how to deal with people who are not in favor of us, not liking us. And this is something, of course, very, very natural. Throughout the process of your life, you're always going to come across with certain people who might be different with you in their ideology, in their opinion, in their conduct, in their behavior. There might be a dispute, there might be certain issues that escalate to such a level where they become hostile towards you. Now, there are different kinds of that level of hostility that a person has towards somebody else, but it's never going to be something good or something positive. Don't put yourself in such a situation where you are going to gain enemies. قال لقمان لابنه, Luqman said to his son, from what he said to his son, لا تتخذ عدواً واحداً, don't even have one enemy. والواحد كثير, and even having one enemy is too much. And so we need to have that kind of attitude where, you know, we minimize our interaction with someone who we know will turn out to be a headache for us, if we could say. Do the means justify the end? Do we have this kind of sense where, well, seeing that it's an enemy, it doesn't matter what I do to him or her, you know, they're an enemy, you know, they're not Muslim, they're not religious, they're doing wrong to me, so therefore I'm going to do wrong back to them. Should you steep low to their level and react to them the same way that they are dealing with you? Absolutely not. And that's why, in any case, we need to always remember to have that level of adl, to be just and fair, and also to make sure that we are munsif in our treatment of those who are against us as far as enmity is concerned. That's why the Quran says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَلَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَلَّا تَعْدُلُوا اعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَىٰ, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that there might be a group of people who, you know, push you towards not being just, not having adala. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, اعْدِلُوا هُوَ أَقْرَبُ, and it is always going to be closer to taqwa. Imam Ali alayhi salam saying to his son, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, his advice he gives to him, أُوصِيكَ بِتَقْوَى اللَّهِ فِي الْغِنَى وَالْفَقْرِ, I remind you of being wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the case of richness and in the case of poverty. And then he says, وَبِالْعَدْلِ عَلَى الصَّدِيقِ وَالْعَدُوِ, and for you to be fair, for you to be just towards your friend or your foe, towards your friend or your enemy. Imam Ali also said to his other son, Muhammad al-Hanafiyya, وَبْذُلْ لِصَدِيقِكَ نَفْسَكَ وَمَالَكَ, and give to your friend, yourself, and your wealth. Sacrifice everything to your friend. وَلِلْعَامَّةِ بِشْرَكَ وَمَحَبَّتَكَ. And for everyone else, your smile and your compassion. وَلِعَدُوِكَ عَدْلَكَ وَإِنصَافَكَ. And you should give to your enemy your justice and your fairness. That's the kind of attitude that we need to always have when it comes to sharing what it is that Islam says to us, to those who are at enmity with us.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
From Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, that says that even when it comes to the time of testifying, that you should never testify something false against your enemy. وَلَا يَكْتُمُ شَهَادَتَهُ لِلْأَعْدَاءِ. Then even if there is an enemy, that you shouldn't be concealing your testimony for your enemy. In the case of the enemy, whatever it is, you should never transgress their rights. Even if they are your enemy, they still have حقوق and rights, which is exactly why from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, we can understand that there needs to be that level of tolerance, there needs to be that level of overlooking as well, even if it is your personal enemy. Akrim man waddaka, be graceful to those who loves you. Wasfah an aduwika, and overlook your enemy, or be tolerant, or bear the difficulties of your enemy. Yatimu laka al-fadl, and you will become among those who have perfect virtue. And so in all, we can understand that this is the kind of approach that we need to have towards those who are our personal enemies. And of course, that's not something easy. It really does need a lot of tahdhibun nafs and a lot of patience as well, which is exactly what we can see consistent throughout the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
The light.
A mesmerizing hot air balloon festival has got on the way in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The sky was littered with nearly 100 beautifully colored hot air balloons in different shapes, captivating every viewer. The awe-inspiring event brought together COVID-wary citizens to experience joy and jubilation amid health restrictions. Pleasant weather made the experience all the more enjoyable. The 38th annual New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning is likely the largest outdoor entertainment event in the tri-state area since the pandemic began.
Nostalgia is in the air in Paris as streets of the city are enlivened, that is, with old vehicles. The French capital has hosted an annual parade called Summer Crossing of Paris. It brought together over 700 vintage cars, motorbikes, buses, and tractors from all over Europe. The route started from Vincennes Castle, east of Paris, and ended in the southwest of the city. Drivers cross the iconic monuments such as the Eiffel Tower and the Arc de Triomphe.
It is extraordinary because the automobile industry heritage and the Parisian architectural heritage, which is obviously absolutely fabulous, echo each other. We are driving through all of Paris's most beautiful squares.
The 14th version of the event drew hundreds of enthusiastic visitors from across France. People were asked to wear masks and keep social distancing because of COVID-19. Tehran municipality has inaugurated an art garden that puts on display Iran's art and culture. As Youssef Jalali reports, the cultural facility aims to reconnect visitors with Iran's rich past amid increasing preoccupation with modern lives.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting, and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as this large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
Palazzo Farnese is one of the most famous palaces in Rome and is being used as the French embassy. However, some of the rooms there are not open to the public. Now, an artist has come up with a creative way to show the historic building to everyone. An Italian artist known as JR has created a mural art installation on the French diplomatic mission in Rome. The artwork is equivalent to a virtual hole and shows what the building would look like if there were no outside walls. JR has conducted similar dazzling projects on other buildings, including a mural in the city of Florence, providing people with a sneak view of architectural masterpieces.
Cockatoos in Sydney suburbs have learned a new way to scavenge for food, opening wheelie bins with their beaks and claws. Australian researchers have found out that the parrot family birds are learning the ability from one another. Moreover, the scientists have discovered that cockatoos in different neighborhoods have distinct styles and approaches to pry open the bins. Although the birds opening bin lids seems to be a simple action, it shows a more complex behavior pattern that proves animals can learn, share, and develop subcultures. In some rural areas, online education during the pandemic seems a challenge, as students do not have access to smartphones. In the Indian state of Jharkhand, teachers have come up with an innovative idea to tackle the problem. Turning walls of houses into blackboards is the solution. Under this circumstance, students can learn in the open air while maintaining social distancing. Teachers use loudspeakers to manage the classrooms. Parents welcomed the idea as most of them could not afford a smartphone and a fine internet connection. They also built platforms for students to sit on while attending classes. There is a famous quote, one should always try to turn every disaster into an opportunity. A Swiss hiker with Parkinson's disease has put that saying into practice by hiking more than 1,100 kilometers across the Alps. Yves Aubusson, suffering from the disease for more than 16 years, completed the challenge in less than 100 days last year. During his journey, he scaled high-altitude peaks and crossed nearly 100 mountain passes. Aubusson says his first goal was to inspire fellow patients to be active even if they are gravely affected by the incurable disease. But, he says, his major motivation was to raise awareness of the debilitating neurological illness, which is little known.
What motivated me to do this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Luriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness Record adjudicators. Luriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Luriano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. But I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Luriano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year. In the U.S., creative designers are trying to raise awareness about the environmental issues in a fun and playful way. A climate change-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy inefficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artist, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curving hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the inverted dome. The viewing area of the inverted dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a five-year construction process in the city's Linglong district.
Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform three surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. The Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely it's against each other. But in the same time, we think it's in the digital and the nature is quite easy to it's merged.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind.
Celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Qadir.
In the limelight.
According to interviews with 10 leading COVID-19 experts, vaccine protection remains very strong against severe infections and hospitalizations caused by any version of the coronavirus.